Welcome to the serial audiobook Pandemic. An unabridged presentation of Book 3 in the Infected Trilogy, written by Scott Sigler and performed by Phil Giganti. This novel is available in print, ebook, or as a full-length uninterrupted audiobook. For links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Audible, iTunes, and more, please visit scottsigler.com. Hello, junkies.
Hey, this is my show.
Oh, is that? No. This is Pandemic, bro. This is not Story Smack.
Dadgummit.
This is Pandemic. Hello, junkies. How the hell are you? It is now episode number 41 of Pandemic. It is our annual, not annual, our
end of podcast.
End of podcast Q&A episode.
Traditional.
That's the word we're looking for. One of the most popular things that we do is we get down into the weeds and you people send us questions.
By which you mean?
You people. Yeah. That's what I mean. You guys send us questions and we answer them about the podcast that we have just completed, which in this case happens to be Pandemic. 40 girthy episodes of horror sci-fi goodness. It is complete. I hope you guys stuck around for the whole thing. I hope you enjoyed it. If you already read it and you skipped the podcast, that's cool. We're glad to have you here for this Q&A. With me today, tables have turned, ma'am. With me today is my Q&A co-host. That's right, A. Kovacs. The director of Doom, a real girl herself, A. Kovacs, which
hey.
I said twice.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm very happy that we're done with the pandemic.
Yeah, it's been a really big month. This has been a really big month at the Lair of Doom. A
lot of stuff going on in Lair of Doom.
Pandemic ended, which ends a quite long trilogy.
40 weeks. Oh, the trilogy, yeah.
Overwhelmingly.
Huge.
But also the 40 weeks.
Huge.
Yeah. Like an orange and a toothpick.
Huge. Like an orange and a toothpick.
And we released Earthcore to critical acclaim.
Yes, lots of critical acclaim. Make sure if you guys listen to it, make sure you review that thing on Audible and Amazon.
Yeah, review it by audio or ebook. We'll take a review if you have it.
And in case you haven't heard, I don't think we've announced this on the podcast yet. That's right, we have not. Earthcore is now available. It is a 19-hour audiobook. It has been completely rewritten from bottom to top. The original one that you guys have heard before was 120,000 words. This one's 180,000 words.
And 60,000 words of those are swapped out and different.
Yeah. Completely.
Or 80,000 words, I mean. So there's changes to the first 120 that you've already read. You should read the whole
thing. It's basically the difference, I believe, between playing Tecmo Bowl, 8-bit Tecmo Bowl.
Sure.
Busting open Madden 2017. It's the same concept, but it's a drastically different product.
I will tell you this. Our ebook. Our ebook assembler, editor, engineer. His name is Chris Casey. He's been working with us for a long time. He's a junkie. He's fantastic.
Great guy.
He emailed to say, I feel like I should say, and I'm going to say as soon as the book finally comes out, this wasn't my favorite book until I read it again. And this is by far my favorite Sigler book. The writing is better. It's more intriguing. It's more compelling, all this other stuff. And I was like, yes, please say that. And then he knows quite a lot about it, but Steve Rickyberg is sort of the same way.
Yeah, Steve Rickyberg's our audio engineer.
And he's been in the trenches too, and he's like, this was great to listen to.
It's straight fire, or as my nephews would call it, D1 bound.
D1 bound.
My Earthcore is D1 bound.
So we did Earthcore.
We did, and just to mention, Ray Porter, the 2015 Audible Narrator of the Year, recorded our joint. That's how powerful it is.
Such a great guy.
So it's available. You go to scottsigler.com/earthcore. There are links to buy that sucker on Audible and on Amazon, and it'll be on Barnes & Noble soon, and then iTunes soon.
We'll that's actually worth mentioning. So it came out on Tuesday. We did the pre-release for everything that we could pre-release it on, but you can't pre-release a lot of formats. So it's populating to, I know like Audible Germany doesn't have it yet.
We got a German fan question today. We did.
Oh, we did. Okay. Yeah. So I know those things are, but that just propagates when it propagates. And because it's not a primary, it's not the primary language, sometimes that takes a backseat. So it's coming, and that's all. We can't do anything more than just forward emails, but those are coming, and iTunes is coming, and Nook is coming, and all that stuff.
Wasn't that a Will Smith line, one of his songs? Picked up a cell phone to perpetrate like he was propagating. I don't think I have that right.
I don't think you have that right. No. I don't really know, though. I'm not big on my Will Smith
This is why
songs.
I'm not a rapper.
So it is also in May. We posted the registration for Siglerfest. So
if you guys are Scottsigler.com/Siglerfest.
Yeah, it's October 6th and 7th in Las Vegas. It's a super fun time. Really, it's a fan appreciation weekend. I know it's called Siglerfest. It's kind of all about you guys. We hang out. We do goofy things. There's no rules. There's no tests. There's no sleep, really.
Not much sleep.
Lots of booze and lots of singing and lots of programming on Friday and Saturday. It's super fun.
It's a celebration of life is what it is. We get together and fantastic times are had as we contemplate our own mortality and existence and rage against it. Rage, I say.
Also, we bowl and play karaoke.
We do bowl.
We sing karaoke. We play games.
Yeah, it's
super fun.
Grand time. And lots of other things. Go ahead. What else do we do?
So
I don't remember. I'm like, I'm in a coma.
We did Siglerfest. We put out Earthcore.
You guys can't see it, but I'm like twitching right now.
Yeah. We have actually news we can't quite talk about. Also happened in May. Moving the chains down the field Hollywood a little bit. We'll talk about it soon.
A tiny step further along for Hollywood.
And we finished pandemic. So this is the moment in the podcast where I say every single thing we will say from here on out is very likely a spoiler.
Spoiler.
The invitation to send questions at the end of a podcast for any given book is a broad invitation. You can send any question you have. Yep. There is no question not worth sending. There are some questions not worth answering or not able to be answered, but he's going to try and he'll just tell you.
I will be the arbiter of these decisions.
But this is the moment. If you haven't read Infected, get ready. There may be Infected spoilers. If you haven't read the GFL, there may be GFL spoilers.
I would like to point out I'm watching Vikings season one right now. And for the rest of this podcast, I will be the Earl Ragnar of questions.
I don't really know what that means, but that's okay.
If you've watched Vikings, you know what I'm talking about. I will be the Earl of the questions. Here we go.
Here's how this is going to work. Okay. We have some that are MP3. I know one is at least 2 minutes long, so that may or may not get cut off.
He'll probably cut that off.
But I'm going to intersperse those. So sometimes what will happen, because Scott doesn't like to see the questions beforehand, is you will have asked a question that will get answered in advance, and we'll just kind of roll through that. So if you sent a question that doesn't get answered by your name specifically, but we answer it in general, understand that we're just not going to answer the same question 17 times.
Got it.
All righty. So we are going to start.
Slap it up, flip it, and rub it down.
And reverse it. So we're going to start with D. Peter Mayer.
It's D1 bound rap skill.
I got you, son. Let's go. All right. I'm going to start with D. Peter Mayer because Peter sent in a bunch of questions.
And okay,
is a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Yep.
Hi, Scott. I loved Pandemic. Contagious was the first of your novels that I ever listened to. And when it was over, I couldn't wait to see what happened next. While I waited, I listened to everything else of yours that I could get my hands on. And I became hopelessly addicted as a junkie. Mm-hmm. It's been a wonderful journey. On to the questions. One. Will it be difficult to rewrite Earthcore now that it takes place after Pandemic in the timeline?
Can I answer that?
How do you think society would change after such a wrenching event?
Can I answer that?
Of course.
Listen, Peter, brah.
Sir.
Sir, pick up Earthcore audiobook or ebook and find out, because it does now take place after Pandemic, and I have accounted for that. So this is an intricate dance that I did, which is... Since the Siglerverse is a continuum of stories, not a series, but a continuum. They all happen sequentially one after another. And the first date of the story happens to be the actual real day that the book is published, or very, very close to it. So that you can follow along. So something having a pandemic or Earthcore, June of 2017, the book is out in late May of 2017. Follow along that way. And all the events continue on. So Pandemic happened in 2013. Is that right? Yeah. So we're 4 years later. I think so. 2013. 4 years later, now we get to Earthcore, and you get a slice of how does a nation like the United States recover from a cataclysmic event like what happens in Pandemic? How is the world recovering? So it was a really interesting challenge. And I had to keep this in mind when I wrote Pandemic. How do I destroy the world, but leave enough of the world left in place that I can continue to write the kind of stories that I like and not have to start a new timeline?
Well, and I think one of the things about Earthcore specifically, which is Peter's question, is Earthcore, for however sweeping, and I know a lot of you who are listening are quite familiar with the general idea of the story, having listened or read the first one. While the idea is very broad and far-reaching, the actual story takes place in a very small amount of real estate as well.
Yes.
And that actually helps. You call it, it's a location lock or something like that, where
isolation. Yeah.
So I think that helps as well in this story, in the updated pandemic, post-pandemic.
That helped a lot. Yeah. And future modern day stories. Maybe we can talk about that. If we have time at the end, we'll talk about the strategy going forward after the GFL.
And sure.
It'll help. It all pays off.
I have many more questions, sir.
Let's go.
Peter has another. What do we do? When do the Prawat leave Earth?
It's none of your goddamn business.
Okay, they came about after the nuking of Detroit, but I don't think they could have left before the events of pandemic. Do they play a role in recovery?
It's none of your goddamn business. Just keep reading and or listening and or buying the books, and we will get to it.
Number three, what happens to normal people exposed to the Hydras? Do they experience any side effects from the unchecked Hydra growth?
No, they do not.
Because it's tethered to the human that was the Hydra.
Yeah, it's a lot like if you happen to have the antibody for a virus to which you are never exposed, does the antibody cause you any problems or side effects? And the answer is almost always no.
Well, and the thing about Hydra is that they can absorb, but it's a finite amount of time in their growth process that they can amalgamate extra sort of biomass.
Yes.
Yeah. So, let's see, number four, why did the orbital include hatchlings in its final batch of infectious seeds?
Because it's a model that works, and if you go back and read it again, I hope you do, there's a lot of subtext in this. The orbital has a very limited amount of time and a very limited amount of resources. It knows it has at least one design that actually works, functions, performs a role, and it can replicate successfully. It's going to invest some of its resources into this successful model so that it's got, let's call it, a workforce available for the experimental models, some of which it has no idea if they will turn out or not. Mm-hmm. So you have to put yourself in the orbital shoes.
Well, sort of all of which, because it can't predict where it lands. It can only predict what it sends.
It's got, right now, the orbital knows, I got this one thing for sure, will probably work if it hits the right population. I'm going to include that as part of my ordnance package. I'm going to take the round that works and then gamble a little bit on the things that we don't know if they work or not.
Did the orbital plan to be around to direct the infected for the final batch?
In pandemic, the orbital, no. I think if you go back and read it again, and hope I have this right, the orbital knew its ass was grass. It was screwed.
It's sort of like Cassini, right? Headed out past Saturn.
Yep.
It has done its work. It's still functioning. It mm-hmm. will still receive information and it can still process information, but there's a finite amount of time and it can only do so much.
You know what it is?
Nope.
It's Khan. My last breath, I spit at thee. When Khan was trying to take Kirk out and Khan knew he was dead, like, no, not this new Khan. Nothing against Benedict Cumberbatch, but the old Khan, Ricardo Montalban, that's Khan. That's the man.
Well, TV he also show had a and feathered movie. Mullet, dude.
Oh,
a
my
feathered
God.
Feathered mullet.
If you youngsters have never seen The Wrath of Khan, the old Wrath of Khan with Ricardo Montalban, you got to go back and watch it. It's a dope, it's a very good movie. But Khan's final act is, as he's dying, as everyone around him has died, he loads up the Genesis device, I think it is, and tries to launch it at Kirk to take Kirk out. That is very akin to the orbital. The orbital has one shot. It's not going to see the result of its initiative, but it gives it everything that it can. So no, it was not planning on controlling things.
You mean it has one shot, one opportunity?
One opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. Like, and that's kind of what it does. It's like, well, fuck, I'm going out either way. Let's just go.
Going out straight D1 baller.
Well, okay. Yes, okay. That too. So next question, did the orbital plan to be around? Oh, no, no.
That was it.
Sorry. In the contagious Q&A, you mentioned that the reason portals aren't used later in the Sigliverse is because they're vulnerable to static. You also hinted you might elaborate on that concept in a later story. Could you please write that story while I go turn off my cell phone?
Yeah, I was going to say. Okay, so by portals, he means, okay, the gates, vulnerable to static. You know, this could be the heroine talking, but I don't think that's exactly right. So let me break it down to you as best I can recall. Is portals take an enormous amount of energy to power. We're talking about D-Day. This is basically a D-Day invasion. Yes, America geared up for one D-Day invasion, right? The Allies gear up for one D-Day invasion. Could they throw out a D-Day invasion every year, every other year, every 2-3 years? Probably not. So the portals were a massive initiative to create an invasion force, a story which will be told somewhere down the road. I realize the erogenous zones are now tingling, but what? Somewhere down the road, I will be able to tell this story, bring it all to fruition. But no, the biggest reason those aren't continued to be used, there's two big reasons. Number one, they're labor intensive, they're resource intensive. Here's the thing, I'll avoid spoilers. The sentients who made the gates ruined their economy making the gates, right? They were counting on being able to go somewhere and get new resources and get new revenue from the places they go to fund the debt they went into building the gates in the first place. That didn't happen. The other thing that happened in the GFL is another technology came in and overtook it, and that is the punch drive. The punch drive came in and was a whole brand new technology. It's comparable to, we're talking about the electric car versus the horse and buggy.
Right.
In between the horse and buggy electric car, there's this whole internal combustion engine, which replaced the horse and buggy, and then there's a whole generation next, which is the electrical car. That's the difference between punch drive and the gates.
Are you ever going to write a buggy versus Tesla story?
Yes. There's going to be a lot of splattered horses and dead Amish.
Are the collectors and the givers related?
No, they are not. Is this still Peter?
This is still, he wrote a bunch and they're very well thought out and I'm reading them all. Fuck it.
Okay. Well, we'll get to it.
I know.
No, they are not related. Although they may have had interactions in the past, but I will go ahead and burst your bubble. That is not a story I will ever get to. Is those two interacting before they got to the Milky Way galaxy. Now, a side note, everybody calls it the Milky Way galaxy in the GFL. That's right, right? That's what we call it. Our galaxy is the Milky Way galaxy.
We do, yes.
It's not like we're like Milky Way 90210, which is a zip code. Like, it's the Milky Way galaxy.
I mean, I'm going to assume we all call it the Milky Way galaxy, but other people who live here may call it something else.
You know, when we destroy them and take them over, they will use our lexicon. Our nomenclature will rule.
I mean,
next question, Peter.
Why did Dr. Montoya succumb to depression about Detroit when her marriage to Otto was initially happy, and that also happened after Detroit?
You're trying to second guess the human mind. It's one of those things. Now, yeah. Keep in mind, she...
I mean, why? Because she's human.
She's human. She made the call to kill about 750,000 people at the initial burst in the fallout, and then who knows how many in the years to come. And I tried to use Montoya as an example for what a shit show the internet and talk radio and the news cycle is. Keep in mind, I wrote this before Trump, you guys. This is not about Republican or Democrat, but you can watch what happens. Somebody does something which seems like the right thing, seems altruistic, and are doing the best job that they can. Then the other side comes in and picks that apart and turns them into a pariah. It happens all the time. And she got turned into a pariah by people who want to get put in office.
Right. And the interesting thing about that is the moment that she becomes a pariah is very public and very broad. But the moment she takes responsibility for having killed all those people because she decides, yeah, you know, at least that part is true. I am the one who chose that. That's a really difficult thing. I mean, I don't think I could choose, yes, please put this dog at the shelter down because I won't adopt it. Could you imagine killing hundreds? Like, it's an impossible burden to carry.
Imagine the guilt of being the one who had to make the call. I'm going to drop two nuclear weapons on Japan.
And I do think that thing
or atomic
grows
weapons,
on,
excuse me. I think
yeah,
eventually
atomic weapons. And I think that thing grows on you, right? You can say like, yes, because if I kill 300,000 people, I will save 300 million people.
Just
you can say that in the esoteric and in the theoretical, right. And then you yourself have to live with whatever that
is. Just because it's the right decision doesn't mean it doesn't have consequences.
And the other part of that is just because it was the wrong decision doesn't mean it that you can live with the consequences. We've all done that. We've all been like, woohoo, I'm going to have 10,000 beers out at this party. And then the next day you wake up and realize you told everyone exactly what you thought of them and you regret that too.
With Nagasaki and Hiroshima, if you're looking at the lay of the land, that is a decision that a lot of people would say was an impossible decision, also the right call. If you're looking in the context of contagious, it is an impossible decision, absolutely the right call, which is what I try and establish by the end of pandemic. That Margaret Montoya, this mid-level CDC worker who just
saved the world.
Happens to be twice, saves the world, not once, but saves the world twice.
Right.
And her decision within the context of this trilogy absolutely saved the entire human race. And she's still racked with guilt because of all the people she had to kill to make that happen.
Right, but it's personal versus societal, right? From a societal level, I can look at Margaret and say, yes, you saved the world and you did it twice. Mm-hmm. And you did it without even compunction. You were like, yep, got to do this. Mm-hmm. No, I would need $1 million and a volcanic lair. None of that, which still would have been worth it.
Still nuke babies. She still nuked babies.
She still did. But yeah. On puppies. A societal level, it's super easy to say right choice. Yeah. On a personal level, when you're like, shit, I don't even like to waste milk because somebody, something made that. And then I killed 2-3 million people. Yeah, I can't do that.
Right.
Okay, so we're going to try doing a... MP3 questions from Ariok.
You got your volume cranked up all the way?
I do now. And Ariok. We're going to try this. Ariok,
let's
go. It looks like this is a 2-minute long thing, but well, I'm not sure if it's more than one
Ariok,
question.
We might cut this off if it runs too long, but go ahead. I'll be ready to hit pause.
Greetings, Divine One. This is Flagstaff, a most devoted servant of the Church of Scott Ziegler. I plead you. We beg you to bestow your holy, holy, holy benediction upon us.
Okay.
Ancestry is the most sacred of texts. We have forgot it. Who possesses the intellectual property rights of this hallowed scripture?
Steve may have to underline this one.
Capable of creating the consecrated descendant if Crown still owns the characters you created for them. Please bless Scotland. We beseech you. Set their hearts at ease.
Hit pause. I believe the question was...
And love Ariok.
We're not going back to play that again, so I'm going to answer the question I think he was asking.
Ariok, for the job you want.
The question I believe you were asking was, does Crown own the characters in the in the Infected trilogy, and does that interfere...
Ancestor, he said, right?
And I think it was all asking all Ancestor.
Well, just answering them.
Let's
in
go
general.
With all the Crown books. Yeah. And does that get in the way of us ruling the world of the Galactic Football League? The answer is no. The author owns the exclusive copyright and intellectual property of all of those characters.
Yeah.
There are a few exceptions by really predatory publishers, but Random House and Crown and Del Rey are absolutely not predatory publishers. They're fantastic publishers. They respect the creator. They respect the creator's rights. I'm in the clear. Everything's good.
Yeah. And I will say this, that is a thing that, again... you own the IP mm-hmm. moving forward for every character, no matter how predatory the publisher. The IP always stays with the creator.
No,
the IP, like the idea that Quentin Byrne exists belongs to you. You can, and sometimes people do, give away pieces of those rights in perpetuity when they're publishing a book or putting out a movie or making an action figure. In this case, one, all your publishers have been great, but also two, we haven't run into too much of that. But in general, I think for Ancestor, which I think he was asking about, those are free and clear for sure.
Free and clear.
And belong just to you.
Yes.
Okay, we'll try
let's give it a little bit more. A little more time.
Please, please, please. Aside, stupid insect. I am Ramron Snooty. The important question is which Hollywood studio will be producing the Hunter Hunterson and Son series.
Ah.
Hey, pause. I'm glad we kept going. Now they switch voices.
Can we have the Snooty?
We may have the Snooty. So guys, if you can't quite hear it, we're going to do another one because this is entertaining to me. So therefore, since I am the Earl Ragnar of questions, we're going to continue. No Hollywood play on Hunter Hunterson Sons right now, but I'm going to go on a limb. I'm going to call my shot. I'm going to point to the left field fence.
Okay, Babe Ruth.
I'm going to say, that's the one. That's the jam.
I think
we're
going to
see that motherfucker
thing.
On TV
I've
someday.
I've said this to you 10,000 times. I don't think I've ever said it out loud on a podcast, maybe at Singlerfest. I think John Tweedy is your legacy character. That is the thing that people will 100 years from now, they may not know Tim Feeley. Sorry, Tim Feeley. But they'll know John Tweedy. That's what I think.
All right.
So also you think...
I think Hunter Hunter and Sons will probably be, if we live long enough, that will be the first TV show that A&I produce, that we put into play and get onto, I'm going to guess Hulu or something along those lines.
Maybe.
But we have a couple of...
I mean, I tell you all the time, the only variable is time.
The only variable is time. We have a couple of hurdles to overcome before we're even close to that. But to me, that is the most TV-friendly property. Oddly, It hits the lowest common denominator in many demographics.
I mean, you're right. I will say this, and I hope it's not telling too many tales out of school. We will get this question a lot. And when we get it, I'm going to reference back to this point in the podcast and say we already answered this. Yep. People ask us very often, oh, have you thought about XYZ? Have you thought about movies for Ancestor? Have you thought about anime for the GFL? And we have thought about all of those things. And we would be happy to talk to anyone at any time in Hollywood who may be thinking the same thing, which means we've brought Hunter Henderson a couple of times to Hollywood. We brought the GFL a couple of times, three times to Hollywood. We've done it in every format. But you always say about Hunter Henderson, it is the Munsters meets the Beverly Hillbillies. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about both those both those shows, is that there's an opportunity for quote unquote normal human people to interact with the primary characters. Mm-hmm. And that's true of Hunter Henderson as well, except Hunter Henderson also has the benefit of not normal human people interacting with the main characters as well. So I do think that it's quite appealing, and I think it's potentially very easy to fit into a bunch of whatever the newest, latest genre is.
I just hope John Goodman lives long enough. I think John Goodman would be great, Hunter.
Be great. Do you want to try one more?
One more from Ariel. Okay.
Hello, FDO, A Real Girl. This is longtime junkie Raj Chaos, a.k.a. Roger from Phoenix. I hope you guys are doing well.
Let it ride.
In
anticipation of the ending of Pandemic, I've been doing something of a tradition of mine and re-listening to the entire back catalog of the Siglerverse, at least all the main novels. And it's really interesting to listen to them flipping back and forth between the main timeline of today and the GFL timeline of 700 years in the future, and just seeing all the connections that are woven throughout the Siglerverse. On top of that, every single character that you meet seems like they're really fleshed out. They have a real backstory, a real life, and you really bring that out. So my first question is, how do you bring that out in your characters and make it feel like they didn't just come off of some template, that they actually had a real life up until the point that they stepped into the story? Okay.
Okay, Rod.
So this is one of those things where there's innate talent in a creator. And I've argued many times with many of my friends on the internet, whether writers have talent or not, yes, creators have talent. I don't think you gravitate towards a particular creative field unless you have some level of talent in it. A natural instinct, a natural...
I think that's the thing you argue the most about. Is it instinct or talent or drive or whatever? Yeah. I think it's a semantic argument.
And I think there's like smells like. I don't think you see a thing and go, oh my God, that's the thing I was born to do, unless you already have a predisposition for kind of wanting to do that thing. If you watch a heavy metal band play and you feel no emotional response to it whatsoever, you're probably not going to pursue a career in heavy metal music. So it's like that. So while there is some level of natural talent in character creation and being empathetic and understanding the basic core principles of what compromises a human being, their needs, their wants, their desires, their hatreds, etc., this is also a standing on the shoulders of giants things. This is the kind of thing where when you read Stephen King or you read Joseph Conrad or you read Jack London and you're reading it and you stop, you go, how did they do that? All of a sudden there's a literal real person in my memories that I know who never existed. And then you go back and read, like, did he do that in four sentences? And you see that. And because going back to when I read the work of people who blew me away with their skill level at doing such amazing work, particularly Stephen King's the master at this. Master at giving you two sentences or one paragraph, and you know that person, you remember that person until the day you die. He's just the best.
Yeah.
When you see that and you are blown away and you go back and you reread it and you reread it and you reread it and try and figure out what they did, that's talent. That's empathy where you're going like, oh, I see this and I want to do it. You don't just gloss over it. So my ability to do those things and make realistic characters comes from a combination of having some natural talent at it and also dissecting the work of the masters and learning how they did what they did and trying to emulate that.
Well, and I also think dissecting your own work, that is also the third part of that, because I think what some people say, like, oh yeah, natural talent, you're just a breeze at this. I know a lot of writers now that I work with you. I know a bunch of writers. Mm-hmm. And I don't know a single one, if they call themselves an architect and do a lot of outlining, if they call themselves a gardener and just see where it goes. I don't know a single one who doesn't fret and sweat and curse over why would their character be right-handed or whatever.
Yeah.
So it doesn't come fully formed. And I think that's what people like me who are non-creative mean by talent. Like, does this just fall all into your head?
That's
and
when you're
like,
doing
sure.
It,
yes. In one way, it totally
when
does.
You're doing it right, you make people think it's easy.
Yeah. But it also absolutely does. It falls into your head that the Sklornow will make churches to football players.
Yeah.
But the practicalities of making that work in a society doesn't fall in. That is a ton of work.
To me, the definition of skill is making something difficult look effortless. And that's what we're really trying to build towards in this space. And to get it down to the Stephen King level, next time I read Stephen King, old Stephen King. I haven't read new Stephen King in a while. No problem with new Stephen King, but old Stephen King was where it was at for me. When he introduced a secondary character, there is a vocal tic, there is a physical mannerism, and he will use the first name, then their last name, then their first name, last name, then their last name, then their first name. And this is the formula. Whether he knows he's doing it or not, in one paragraph, he establishes a character. And
Do you have a moment like that for you for Stephen King? I have a very specific moment where I was like, yep, I'm all in with Stephen King and The Dark Tower.
Which was following that little example there?
Yeah.
Okay, tell me.
It was the moment. Now, by this time, it was the moment that Roland switches planes in The Dark Tower and he's on a physical, actual airplane.
Okay.
And he's gone from the beach with the lobstrosities.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's on an airplane and he somehow gets Keflex, which mm-hmm. is an antibiotic. But he himself, he doesn't quite understand it, but he understands that he's dying because the lobstrosities have bit
poisonous.
Him. And he can't quite figure out this magical Keflex.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very specific little conversation he has with himself about this Keflex. And I read it. I didn't. So that's a visual thing.
Right.
And that's like book two or something. Like it's late. Roland. You know these characters. And all of a sudden you're like, okay, I'm all in. I don't care what happens to him. I'm going to stay this whole route and find out. Because he's fragile in a way that when I read it at 20-something, I wasn't. I knew what that was. So I got to be a tiny bit like, oh, I'm with you. I can help you. How can I help you?
Mine was in The Shining, and it is when, oh my, I just said it. You never forget these guys' names. Jack Torrance. There you go. When Jack Torrance goes to the Overlook and talks to the manager, the grounds manager, who now I can't remember his name, but he manages the boiler. And he's given Jack Torrance a very specific, you need to do this with the boiler at this time or the whole fucking place is going to blow up. Mm-hmm. It's a very serious conversation, except the greenskeeper, whatever his name is, I forget his
grounds.
Name. Groundskeeper, when King introduces him, he's a guy in overalls and he blows his nose a lot. So he pulls a handkerchief out of his back pocket, blows his nose, looks at it, tucks it. Yep. And then which King does this, he introduces you to, here's the sequence of events that this character does. Here's their vocal tic and their physical mannerism. Then he truncates it. Mm-hmm. So after he gives it to you once, then you do the second time, he blew his nose, he peeked to put it away. Then from there on, it's like blow, peek, tuck.
Yep.
Say dialogue, blow, peek, tuck.
Yep.
And all of a sudden it's boom, locked in. And that is the single biggest, that is the outside of Cujo, that is the single biggest hammerfall that's ever hit me in the world of writing and how to make secondary. I'm like, did he just fucking truncate all that down to three words? And I'll never forget it as long as I live.
Yeah, clearly.
So that's where I get a lot of it from.
Oh, let's try the rest of Raj's question. Although Raj and everybody else listening in the future, short questions, probably better.
Yeah, short.
Like five or six or seven. Questions. Exactly. Yeah. Five or six or seven, a little
we're
easier.
We're tech tards here.
Yeah.
Secondly, your world is just so well connected and there's so much going on that you foreshadow and talk about
Raj.
And little hints of connections here and there.
Mm-hmm.
How much of the Siglerverse do you have mapped out in some way, shape, or form?
Oh my God.
How much of that is there just waiting to be written into book form? And then third...
Oh, let's pause that.
I've been typing... I have A has it somewhere. We actually have taken it to Siglerfest a couple times as an artifact.
The vault.
Take the vault, which is on onion paper, typed on a royal typewriter, which is the first timeline of the Siglerverse. And so I've worked it from modern day all the way through the GFL and a little bit beyond, although you guys haven't seen a lot of what happens beyond. So I've been, as far as what all the Siglerverse entails, it's everything that you have read has sort of been pre-planned in a lot of ways. The big structure has always been pre-planned and then little gems will pop up and I will go back. John Viscara is the only person to see this because you don't look at the timeline a lot, but John and I look at it all the time.
I mean, I've seen it. Yeah, but I don't spend a lot of time with it. But John, just so if people don't know, which I can't imagine, he is our continuity czar, John Viscara.
He's the Rain Man of the Sigliverse.
Yes, in a good way.
We are on the 11th draft of the Sigliverse timeline. And every time we write a new book, this goes back into technique, right? It seems effortless. But you go, every time we write a new book and I come up with some plot lines, I'm like, oh, I need to go back and foreshadow that. So now the Sigliverse timeline, which no, you cannot see any of you, is 11 different colors, one for each draft. So every time you write a book, so you can go back and as you see things populate the timeline, you go, oh, that came, he figured that out in the crypt. He figured that out in GFL6, et cetera, et cetera.
And then there's little hiccups here and there, which you guys account for now when you move forward. And I'll give you one tiny irrelevant example, which is Pookie Chang exists in Nocturnal in the modern day. Mm-hmm. And then Pookie Chang's great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandnephew, I guess, is, or maybe grandson, I don't know, is in the GFL. And they're both named Pookie Chang.
Yes.
And that is a thing that happens when, well, right, like you miss because your universe your Sigliverse spans thousands of years. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't remember what I had to eat on Monday. So how could you remember what happened 700 years ago? But working with John, getting to work with John kind of brings that all into a sort of a well-rounded, let me account for that kind of thing, John, which is
John's
fun
a,
for us.
John's a huge resource for us. John and Gamork, Carmen Waman are,
who both
manage the Siglerpedia. They manage Siglerpedia. If you haven't seen Siglerpedia, go to scottsigler.com, look at the nav bar at the top of the page, go to Siglerpedia, look up anything you can think of in Siglerverse, and there's probably information or a whole page there. But having those people as resources to help me keep track of all this is huge. So the answer to your question, bro, is I'd say about 75% of what you see was figured out when I was like 10. And the other 25% where it really comes, the shine, the polish has come as I've gotten older and better. That doesn't count the writing. The writing's a separate thing. But the overall structure of the Sigliverse, most of that has been in place for a long time.
All right, we're going to try this one.
See if we finish up.
And then we're going to go to me reading questions.
Okay.
In Infected, it seems like Perry Dossie might be the main character. And that continues into Contagious, and he kind of becomes main characters along with Dew as they become buddy-buddy. But then the ending happens, and well, in the third book, Perry and Dew aren't there, but you still have Margaret and Otto and, oh geez, what's his name, the old guy? Anyway, who is the main character of this trilogy? And thank you for being fucking amazing and keep up the great work. Peace out.
I love Raj. Raj and I go way back.
We do. You go way back. So the main character in the first two books, I believe the first book is clearly Perry. Mm-hmm. In the second book, I think it's Perry and Margaret are sort of fighting for screen time, but it's still primarily Perry.
But, and Dew.
And Dew's a huge, huge part of that. And then it's an ensemble cast. The answer to your question, it's an ensemble cast. Because first book, clearly it's Perry. But then I think second book, it's Perry, it's Dew, it's Margaret. Third book, it's Margaret, it's Tim, it's Clarence Otto. It's more of a Seinfeld type thing. There's not one particular star through the whole thing.
Oh, and I actually, it's interesting. As a reader, I might disagree with you. Okay. I would say that Perry is clearly the main character in Pandemic. I'm sorry, in Infected and Contagious. And what's hard for me as a reader, hard and great and hard and you motherfucker and great, is that you are willing to kill your darlings, right? Like I, as a reader, as an American reader of a certain age, I am used to, you're going to write this story, I'm going to get super invested in Perry and he's going to save himself and save the world.
Yes.
And that doesn't happen.
Doesn't always happen in my books, no.
And then it happens fucking again. Like, okay, fine, Perry, I didn't get that. I didn't get my happy ending. Okay, let's do it again. Oh, I don't get my and then a third time, I'm like, right, of course, the girl is going to save, I'm a girl, she's a girl, it's going to be great.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It turns out that's not how that works. And that actually for me as a reader, because in case anyone who is listening to this doesn't know, the reason that we're business partners is I started out by reading Infected and loving it and listening to the podcast and loving it and going to a convention and saying hello.
Yeah.
So I am also a very, very, very big reader. And that's one of the best and worst things about reading a Sigler book is you honestly don't know who's going to live through it. And have a lot of evidence to suggest the thing you're really investing in, that thing you're hanging your hat on, isn't going to pan out for you.
That's keep you on the edge of your seat. Yes. All right, what do we got? You're going to read me one.
All right. I am going to read you one now. Okay. Thank you so much, Roger. I understand you have a handful coming more. We'll see if we get to those, but I'm going to read a few. Okay, this is from John Vizcari, who we just mentioned.
We just shined up John. This better be a good question.
Hi, I just have the one question.
If you stump me, you're fired, kid. You got charisma. I'll give you that.
Pandemic is the most reality-invasive modern Sigliverse story. By that, I mean it has the most far-flinging impact across the entire planet. Previously, the nuking of Detroit was pretty self-contained and wouldn't necessarily affect many people outside of Michigan. Uh-huh. But with pandemic, the spread of the infection is more prolific and has the potential to be a decades-long cleanup. Mm-hmm. Given that your stories work so hard to exist in a singular universe, do you anticipate that the stories will begin to drift from being closely aligned with reality and more into a landscape of your own defining? It seems one easy solution would be to no longer set your stories in the, quote, current, end quote, modern day timeline. But EarthCore is just released into a world possibly reeling from the effects of the current infection. Mm-hmm. I guess the question is, do you foresee any issues in your ability to, quote, keep it real-ish, end quote, or do you feel you may have handcuffed yourself with such an ambitious book?
I understand what you're saying, and I don't feel I've handcuffed myself at all, because all you have to do is look at the course of human history, in particular modern 20th, 21st century, is we have gone through unbelievable cataclysms and turmoil. You look at just the 20th century alone, the amount of people who died at the hands of a few despots, nuclear weapons being detonated, the world going to war, World War twice, three times if you count the Cold War, the amount of carnage that has gone on, entire cities being leveled by weapons that could not be conceived of 100 years earlier, and those cities are built again and completely flourishing and doing great, overall mm-hmm. doing pretty great. So you have to look at the resiliency of human spirit, of human emotion, of technology, and the fact that we're just crazy fucking ants building things all the time. You level something, it ain't going to stay leveled for very long. You get ruins, right? You get industrial ruins and you get ruins because trade routes change. Sure. And technology changes. But if you have a hot spot like a Detroit, which is a major port, that's absolutely going to be rebuilt. And in future Sigler novels, you will see Detroit rebuilt. You will see Chicago rebuilt. And yes, now the timeline starts to deviate from the modern day quite a bit. So then becomes a game. Where do I set these novels? The next novel I'm planning in the modern day Siglerverse timeline is again set in northern Michigan, possibly the Upper Peninsula. Pretty isolated. Didn't really go through a whole lot of hell. You know, if you live in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, like many small, remote, rural towns in America, you can nuke LA all day. That ain't gonna bother people in North Dakota all that much. It's just not.
Well, it sort of depends. It depends on the reach of the nuke, right? But you can destroy that whole city.
Yep.
Without contaminating the air and the water. People in Nebraska don't care.
And then to bring it back into.
Unless the rock, something happens to the rock. Because if something happens to the rock,
I don't want to live anymore.
Exactly.
I don't care.
But
I don't care.
Other than that, I don't, you know, I think Nebraska.
Dwayne, call me. I got movies for you, bro. Shabam. And then you get into some of the fun of writing, which is the technology magic hand waving. Mm-hmm. You may see in the next Sigler book, they've come up with this thing that mitigates the impact of radiation, or they built this technology, which will rapidly build. Can rapidly build up buildings in a matter of weeks, et cetera. There's things you can do to bring it closer back to what we are going through right now. The purpose of that is so that you can tell modern day stories, modern day sensibilities, and continue to reference current events. Mm-hmm. So no, I haven't handcuffed myself. It's just a matter of putting in the wrench time to figure out how to bring it back in a line.
Okay. From David Castro.
Yep.
I think we have so many questions. We may go to.
I believe it's going to go to
two episodes. Yeah. But keep me posted on time.
I got you. We'll cut it off in an hour.
Okay, great. David Gastro writes, I'd like to start by thanking UNA for everything you guys do.
You're welcome, sir.
I remember reading on the wiki that it was the Key who sent out the orbitals throughout the galaxy, and I'd like to know if GFL timeline humans know this.
Was it the Key?
Or. What's the GFL timeline history say about all the Siglerverse stuff that happened in the past, like the Infected series / Ancestor? Thank you again, David, humble servant, until I fall victim to the FDO.
David, the Key came through the gate, but we don't know if it was the Key. We don't know who did it.
Right. What we know is the key were the people forced through the gate, were the sentients forced through the gate or walk through the gate. We know that they're the ones through the gate.
They came strapped up, ready to blast some gats, throw some lead, you know, but no, I can't answer that question. All of the answers you're looking for are in the timeline, which is in the Siglopedia. Gamorka's kept the timeline relatively up to date. I have not allowed, I've asked her to leave some stuff out, but those answers are there. And what was the second part of his question again?
That was it.
Okay. Yeah. So the answer is, do humans know? Was that?
Oh yes. Sorry. An earlier part of the question was, do the JFL era humans know that the key were the people who came through the gate and infected, the sentients who came to the gate?
Maybe, but what you got to remember is it's 700 years ago.
Now think about that, right?
1400.
So I am a person who is almost completely of Irish descent.
Uh-huh.
I cannot tell you one single battle that may have happened in the land that my family now lives and owns and has lived and owned for 100 years.
1417. Do you know anything that happened in Ireland in 1417?
Not only that, I also have a super possessive family who is very possessive of the piece of Ireland they have owned for more than 100 years. And that doesn't mean a thing because that's not 700 years. I have no idea how they, like what happened in the 500 or 600 or 700 years ago.
Right. So, I mean, you got to go back and look at what was Europe like in 1417? What was North America like in 1417? To give you perspective, there's an awful lot of American Indian tribes that had a certain lifestyle and culture in 1417. And now that shit's just gone, right? And a whole new world is in place and different iterations of the world. So no, I don't think anyone in the JFL gives a dirty rat shit that it was the key who came through the gate. If they even know it at all, and they probably don't. Because in 2686, public school education is just as shitty as it is today.
Right. Well, and to be fair, we can all think about this. I literally can think of, I know what the history of Ireland is roughly.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't matter at all. I don't know. Like I'm Irish, of Irish descent. You're mostly of German descent. I don't think there's a ton of overlap, but honestly, I have no idea. And it doesn't matter at all because I still want to run a business with you because now we're us.
Well, we're living in the modern world. We're living in our epoch, our era. So yeah. So I'm very confident in the work that I've created that timeline wise. I think that sometimes you read science fiction or historical fiction and there's some event that happened 800 years ago and people are rallying around and it's just, it doesn't happen that way. We have a pretty short memory as a species.
Right. Overall, I mean, I'd rather
good
remember
for about 150, 200 years. And right, after that, we don't care.
I was just about to say that. I would rather remember that in the 1950s, people were born with polio and I don't want to do that again, but I can probably forgive something that happened on another continent 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Sooner than I will forgive something that could affect my continent today, kind of thing.
Gotcha.
Okay. Ben Shively has sent a whole bunch of questions. I'm going to read a couple of these.
Let's go.
Scott and A, re-listening to the Infected trilogy was great, great, great. So much fun hearing Perry and Du. Perry is still one of your best characters.
Thank you.
I do have a few questions about the Siglerverse. One, how do Hydras affect the evolution of the human race?
Oh, that's a fascinating question. The answer is, I may have to go back and think about this.
I mean, do they?
Or I don't think. I don't think Hydras are germline DNA. Germline DNA is, if I get this wrong, my consultants are going to kick me in the nuts. Germline DNA is what is at the core level of your DNA. So your X chromosome, your Y chromosomes, et cetera, things that are passed on that you inherit from your parents. That is the germline DNA. So to change that, if you change things so that when your traits are passed on to the next generation, that is what impacts evolution. Everything else is in effect, forgive me if I get this wrong, Lamarckian, right? It is affecting the individual, not affecting the species. Only things that affect the germline DNA are affecting the species. So unless the Hydras are hard-coded in the sexual, in the XY chromosomes that are, the next generation will produce them as well, they will just die out. They will be virus-like. They will not be propagated by the species. They will be continued due to contagion and infection. Exposure is what I was looking for.
Okie doke. So he has several questions.
Hit the next one.
I'm going to actually hit... the next one is, do Hydras assist the human race in surviving outer space travel? I think you've kind of covered that. Yep. What kind of interesting human experiments would you get if the Hydras, he's very focused on the Hydras.
They're fascinating.
Fascinating.
I love the Hydras. Yeah. They're great.
If the Hydras are combined with the Z chromosome for Marie's children, wouldn't that be fun?
Great idea.
Except I think you've destroyed the Hydras.
Can you ever really destroy them?
I mean, I'm not the creator, so I don't know the answer. I'm going to assume the answer is no.
I don't know. We're still heading for... Okay, I'll let you guys peek under the kimono a little bit. There's a story I want to write, which is some nocturnals getting infected by the contagion that is in pandemic and seeing what kind of fun comes out of that. But hopefully I'll get to it. I don't know if I will. I don't know if I'll live long enough. There's still shit you haven't seen from the nocturnals yet. There's like four squares in the Punnett square that you haven't even seen yet. The 9-square Punnett square. I suppose the 4-square Punnett square. If you guys don't know what a Punnett square is, look that up, then go read Nocturnal. You will thank me for it later.
Okay. So one more question. Mm-hmm. Well, I think maybe more than one more question. Okay. Now that the key knows the Earth exists, do they try attacking Earth sometime between 2017 and 2553?
We go back to, we don't know if it was or was not the key. Also,
I mean, it was probably.
Well, the key were involved. We don't know. Don't know who are responsible for that, right?
Right.
And I'm reading a great book by Weston Oaks right now called Grunt Life, and there is an alien invasion, and our heroes are facing multiple species. And I'm only about 25% of the way through the book, and they still have no idea which species is actually responsible for what's going on. Mm-hmm. Similar concept with that. We don't know which species is responsible.
Right.
But going back, it's all in the timeline over in the Siglopedia. The amount of money and resources invested into that technology destroyed an entire empire, which we haven't seen yet, but they went broke financially. Similar to the Cold War, America outspent Russia, and Russia went so far into debt that they wound up having a lot of trouble because of their effort to keep up. So that's what happened. So no, to answer your question, the answer is no. That was an invasion attempt. It failed. It cost way too much money for them to try it again. And in the interim, another technology came out that supplanted that technology.
Yeah, and I find it very interesting that so much, for me anyway, so much of your military strategery, mm-hmm. I'll call it, is very real world, human, 1900 to 2000 based, right? There are parallels between some of these things we're seeing. Are we going to try and take this beach that we may not succeed, but we need to try? Mm-hmm. World War One tactics. These are things you see. And I think that for me, I sort of read the key coming through the gate like, oh, geez, they sent me here kind of a little, as much as it may be they came through on purpose and they built it.
Yep.
So is it a World War One thing or is it a Cold War thing? Is it? And we don't know. We don't have enough information.
A lot of the poor bastards in those trenches were in World War One. They were not saying, I'm going to go kill me some Germans. I'm going to go kill me some English. They were like, God, I just want to get the fuck out of here. I don't want to be here. Or they were
like, I just want a paycheck for my family at home. Yeah. Like, there's 100 reasons that they would be there. And that doesn't absolve them from all the obligation of what happens, but it does mean that they didn't necessarily build the game.
There's some subtext in the Siglerverse, and it's an area that I don't think a lot of science fiction writers travel in or deal with, and that is the economic consequences of being an invasionary force. And we watched, you look at our own timeline, you can be an empire and you can expand. And at some point that reaches its limit and becomes untenable for an empire to continue to exist for multiple reasons. And there gets a point where like, you just can't invade anymore. Why? Not because you don't want to, it's because you can't afford it. Mm-hmm. You have spent yourself into a hole being this domineering society. And at some point you're like, we need to raise money for troops. Like, dude, there's no money left. We're done.
What we need is a new germline for our corn, which is now full of weevils. Like shit like that.
Shit changes. Yeah. So in the Siglerverse, there's a lot of that, the economic aspects of being an invading army and how does that come back and bite you in the ass?
All right. These next two questions, we're going to do a speed round because we're running out of time.
We're going to do these two questions and we're going to move to part two.
Okay. Well, can we do one more video or audio bookend it? Okay. So, one, speed round. What drove the birthday children from their home to try and reestablish a new human settlement?
Can't tell you. That's in GFL Book 7.
Number six, more of an observation. You do not like the Purist Nation. I'm very curious to see how the last GFL book will tie in with the Generations trilogy.
You've caught me. You've cut me to the quick, sir.
Speed round.
It's... Speed round. How will it impact the next GFL book? Shit ain't gonna go good for some certain people. But yeah, the Purist Nation is an amalgamation of all the wrong elements of all the religions in the world brought together into one. What's not oligarchy? What is it? What is it when it's ruled by religion?
Yeah.
Is that oligarchy?
No, theocracy.
It's brought together into one nasty theocracy, which our boy Quentin Barnes is going to have some interaction with.
All right. So we're going to do one more audio question. Okay. This is Isaac. And Isaac says this was recorded in a park, so you can very faintly hear some birds.
Was it recorded in a van down by the river?
It might have been. By the river! So he says, let me know if the audio is indecipherable anywhere. But Isaac, we're not listening to it till just now. So here we go. It's 1 minute and 36 seconds long, so it could be more than one question.
We may stop him. Go ahead.
Hi, Scott. This is Isaac in Kansas City. I'm the one with the Toe Pirates Memento Mori tattoo.
Nice. Good audio quality.
I finished reading Pandemic about a month or so ago, and I'm recording this before the last episode comes out. So this is going on memory.
Okay.
It's really good story. I like the truth in advertising. It's called Pandemic, and there was a pandemic.
True.
So, one thing that I'm wondering, though, is whatever happened in China, I mean, did we ever find out exactly what was the extent of their damage? Because that was some messed up stuff there. Nukes.
Kind of.
No, and you never will, because the Chinese Communist government is still fully large and in charge down there, and you will hear only what they want you to hear.
But we kind of know that they don't survive unscathed.
Oh, no, of course not unscathed.
Right.
But I tell you, the Chinese are fucking gangsters. They're gonna
I'm a gangster too.
You're not gangster like the Chinese government.
I just got
gangster.
My nails done. They're very red. That's very gangster.
You are. You will not kill a million people to keep a story quiet. They will do that.
I'm not sure they're the only ones.
Let's go.
Okay. Oh, hang on.
Going off left and right. Another question I have is, supposing the infected had actually won, what would they do next? I mean, I know they see themselves as non-humans, as better than human, but basically they're modified humans.
This is not, unfortunately, not speed round shit. This is more complicated.
Well, that's okay. This doesn't have to be speed round. The other one.
The whole infected trilogy, this is a von Neumann device, or von Neumann. I'm not sure if this guy's work has influenced all of my science fiction. I don't know if I pronounce his name right.
Neumann.
We'll call him von Neumann. Von Neumann device. Which is the distances at which you have to travel to hopefully encounter not only another planet that is suitable for life for your species, but another intelligent species on a planet like that is so astronomical that there is this gentleman named von Neumann who theorizes the only way we're ever really going to colonize other planets isn't with people, because people can't survive even multiple generations. The concept of generation ship at the distance we have to travel is ludicrous. It just won't work out. But you can make robots. You can make self-assembling robots.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is you take this core element, and this, you guys will, if you hear this and hear infected in this, it's the basics. You take this core element, you fire off a factory to another planet. And that factory lands on that planet, basically digs in roots. The roots bring in resources, material, metals, and they build workers. And then the workers are able to build a brand new factory that will then launch factories out into space and continue the expansion that way. So,
and interestingly, the factories are, the thing about a von Neumann device that's so interesting is the factories by necessity have latitude. So you send 100 orbitals out,
yep,
for example.
Yep.
And you don't know where they'll land or what they'll do, but that's okay. The outcome, as long as it continues, is a success.
So it's a space virus.
Yep.
What a von Neumann machine is basically is a space virus that will continue to replicate itself and will live much longer than the species that created it.
So we're going to wrap this up with the last bit of Isaac's, I'm not sure if it's a question or not, so we'll hear.
Okay.
So what would they do? Would they just carry on, or would they carry, or would they try to go?
They will die. They will absolutely die. Because the other part of von Neumann device, the evil part, von Neumann's evil twin, his name is Brocco. Brocco von Neumann, as opposed to Eric von Neumann. The purpose of this in the Infected trilogy is to go out, find other races, that are smart enough to achieve faster than light travel so they could eventually compete for resources and kill them in the womb, so to speak.
Which is sort of a shorthand. I mean, it's great as a writer's device because there needs to be enough technological advancement that they're taking care of Maslow's basic hierarchy of needs that they're going to work on faster than light travel.
Correct. And you assume at some point what they hone in on is radio waves. Any civilization that is capable of producing radio signals that go out into space with enough power to go out is at some point eventually going to create faster than light travel. That is the premise of the Infected trilogy. So the probe, the orbital, detects that, comes in, and we're going to kill this civilization in the womb before it can get out and compete. Even though, unfortunately, the civilization that created the orbital has been dead for millions of years. But it's too late because that's what a fucking von Neumann device does. It's a space virus.
What's awesome about that, though, is you're smart enough to build a von Neumann device, and then your civilization dies out.
Yep.
But because the von Neumann device is data from Star Trek, right? It isn't making sentient decisions. It isn't conscious in that way. It is literally going out into space following the things it thinks you want it to follow
its programming.
When you have been dead for 1,000 years, you don't want anything.
It has no way of knowing that.
It's great.
Okay, let's finish up his question and we'll finish up part one.
Yeah, okay.
To the planet that the orbital came from, even though they don't know where that is? I just wonder. Also, okay, so let me get this straight. So all the humans ever since then have these hydras in them. Do they still have them in them in the time of the GFL, or did they get eradicated at some point? And if so, when and how?
Okay.
And lastly, if I go ahead and actually buy the book Alone, will all these questions be answered? Thanks for the stories. Have a good day. Bye.
Okay, so these final two questions. First of all, we don't know. I'm not going to give you an answer to the hydras because they could come into play later. They could die out and maybe
I genuinely believe they're gone.
Yeah, I get that. But then let's get to the more important question. Number one, what you need to ask yourself, sir, is not if I buy a loan, will all of these questions be answered?
I bought it.
The question you must ask yourself is if you buy a loan, what will happen to your soul, your well-being, your immortal being, if you will? And the answer is you, sir, will reach a state of nirvana and you will elevate to a higher plane of existence. And in that plane, you will be happy, you will be successful, and you will be a delightful human being to those around you. So the question, as a real girl said, isn't what answers do you get if you buy a loan? It's why haven't you bought a loan? You know who hasn't bought a loan? Putin. He has not bought a loan.
I mean,
Trump has not bought a copy of a loan.
He might have.
It's true. None of these people have bought a copy of a loan, which means you will differentiate yourself if you go out and buy one and you enjoy it. Ma'am.
We're going to go come back with...
That is part one of the... Steve,
if you're listening, the iceberg, our audio engineer, and I know you're listening because you're editing this. hey, last minute, we're going to do two Q&As. We're going to do two of
these. At least two. We'll see how it goes. Ladies and gentlemen, come back next week. Hear part two of the Q&A. Actually, this has probably been the best Q&A yet. This has been some great fucking questions.
Well, yeah. Okay. So,
and I have had some great fucking answers. Let's be honest with ourselves.
Sure. So here's the most important question some people have been asking on the Facebooks, which you've already answered. What are we podcasting once we're finally done with Q&As? And the answer to that is the writer.
The writer.
That's what's coming next. I know a lot of people want to hear Earth Course. Sorry. You're
going
to have to buy that. Sorry.
Buy that some bitch.
Because we have to pay rent.
19 hours and 42 minutes odd, something like that.
Yeah.
So go buy Earth Core. We'll be back the week after next with the first episode of The Rider. And that wraps up Pandemic episode number 41. Part one of our at least two-part Q&A.
Sorry, Steve.
And you know what, you guys? I think here's why they got to come back next week. You ready? This has already gone an hour. We've gone through one bottle of wine. We're about to start on two bottles of wine. I think part two of the Q&A is going to be a shit show. I'm not going to lie to you.
If there was anyone who listened to our half-baked episode, you should come back right now.
Yeah. Okay. That is it for this week. And until we come back next week, Pandemic Q&A part two, we will talk to you all
real soon.
You have been listening to Pandemic, book three of the Infected trilogy. Written by Scott Sidney. Podcast engineered by Steve the Iceberg Rickyberg. Follow Scott on Twitter and Instagram. His handle is at Scott Sigler, or join our Facebook group, facebook.com/Scott Sigler. Theme music is Believe in Goodbye by Uncrowned.